Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're taking a plunge into the profound ideas of one of the 20th century's most influential thinkers, John Maynard Keynes.
That's right.
And specifically, his groundbreaking work, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money.
A mouthful, but yeah, incredibly important.
Exactly. And look, this isn't just some dusty old economics book. It really is kind of living blueprint for understanding why economies boom and, well, why they bust.
Mm-hmm. And how governments often step in.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack his really revolutionary insights, maybe cut through some of that academic fog.
Yeah, make it clear.
And show why his work fundamentally changed how we understand our economy and, you know, our daily lives.
Indeed. The general theory, it truly stands as a pivotal moment in economic thought. Keynes didn't just, like, tweak existing theories.
No.
He offered a completely new lens. A whole new way to view economic activity.
And it's still highly relevant, isn't it? For policymakers, for us.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, you know, when things feel uncertain economically.
So let's back up a bit. Who was this John Maynard Keynes, the man behind this seismic shift?
He's a fascinating figure.
Yeah. Born 1883, educated at Eton, Cambridge, you know, top schools. He initially studied mathematics and philosophy, actually.
Which is interesting in itself, not straight into economics.
Right, before finding his calling there.
Yeah.
But, and this is key, he wasn't just some ivory tower academic, was he?
Not at all. He was deeply engaged in the real world. Civil servant in the India office, treasury during World War I.
And famously at the Paris Peace Conference after the war in 1919.
Mm-hmm. Where he wrote The Economic Consequences of the Peace.
Yeah, that incredibly prescient book warning about the dangers of hitting Germany with harsh reparations. Mm-hmm. He saw trouble brewing.
And what's really remarkable here is that blend. You know, the theoretical brilliance combined with genuine hand-on practical experience.
It gave him a unique perspective.
Totally unique. He knew classical economic theory inside out. He was taught by Alfred Marshall, one of the giants. But crucially, he also saw the economic catastrophes happening. Post-war instability, problems with the gold standard.
And then the big one.
And then, of course, the Great Depression. The sheer scale of it. The human cost.
Unprecedented.
Yeah. And this combination allowed him to diagnose this fundamental sickness, you could say, in modern capitalism, that the existing theories just, they couldn't explain it.
They had no answer.
They couldn't even really acknowledge the problem the way he saw it.
Okay, so it's against this backdrop, the depths of the Great Depression, that he publishes The General Theory in 1936.
Right in the middle of it.
And its central idea, its thesis, was a direct challenge to the classical economic belief.
The orthodoxy of the time.
Which was that free markets automatically ensure full employment, economic stability.
Yeah.
Everything just works out.
Right. The invisible hand sorts it all out.
Keynes argued, no. Aggregate demand, basically, the total spending by consumers, businesses, government, that is the primary driver of economic activity and employment levels.
He essentially stood up and declared, supply does not automatically create its own demand.
Which sounds simple, but it completely flipped things on their head.
Oh, completely. If we step back, think about the implications. This was a radical refutation of, like, centuries of economic thought.
Wow.
Keynes argued that economies can actually get trapped, stuck in an equilibrium, but one with high unemployment and low output.
Yeah, but classical economics said couldn't.
They couldn't comprehend it. He said, look, insufficient aggregate demand, maybe because people are uncertain, they're hoarding cash.
Psychological factors?
Yeah, driven by psychology. This can create persistent unemployment that markets, left alone, just cannot fix.
It wasn't just poking holes in old ideas.
No, no. This fundamentally reshaped how we think about macroeconomics, about policy. It laid the foundation, really, for active government intervention.
A real intellectual earthquake, as you say.
Yeah. So how did he actually build this new theory? He didn't just say, you're wrong. He systematically dismantled the old assumptions.
Okay, so where did he start?
Well, one of the first targets was the classical idea about labor markets, the belief they always clear automatically, and that employment just depends on real wages.
Meaning, if wages fall enough, everyone who wants a job gets one.
That was the thinking. Keynes introduced the principle of effective demand. He argued employment levels are set where aggregate supply and aggregate demand meet.
Okay.
And crucially, that meeting point could easily be at less than full employment. Lots of people still out of work.
And this directly overturned what?
Say's Law, a cornerstone of classical thought, Jean-Baptiste Say.
Right, Say's law. Remind us what that basically said.
It essentially claimed supply creates its own demand, produce something, and the income generated guarantees it'll be bought.
So widespread unemployment due to lack of demand was impossible.
Considered impossible in a healthy market, yeah. For centuries, that was the bedrock. Keynes basically said, no, that's a fundamental error.
So if people aren't spending enough,
then businesses won't produce as much, they won't hire as many workers, you get stuck in a downward spiral.
A vicious cycle.
That doesn't just fix itself. Demand matters. A lot.
Okay, fascinating. So if demand is so important, how did Keynes break it down? What are the components?
Well, he talked about consumption. He introduced what he called the fundamental psychological law.
Sounds important.
It is. He said, as our income goes up, we tend to consume more, yes, but not by the full amount of the increase. We save some.
Okay, makes sense. You get a raise, you spend some, save some.
Exactly. This means the marginal propensity to consume, or MPC, the fraction of an extra dollar of income you spend, is always less than one.
Right. Maybe 80 cents, 90 cents, but not the whole dollar.
Precisely. And this observation leads directly to one of his most powerful concepts. The multiplier effect.
Ah, the multiplier. I've heard of this. This is where a little bit of spending can have a much bigger impact, right?
Exactly right. The multiplier effect explains how an initial injection of spending, say, government spending on a bridge, can lead to a much, much larger increase in total national income.
How does that work? It sounds a bit like magic.
It does, but it's logical because one person's spending becomes another person's income.
Right.
And a portion of that income gets spent again, becoming someone else's income and so on. It ripples through the economy.
Okay, give us an example, like numbers.
Sure. Let's say the MPC is 0.8 people spend 80% of any new income they get.
Got it.
If the government invests $100, say, paying a worker, that worker spends $80. The person they pay that $80 to then spends 80% of that, which is $64.
I see. It keeps going.
It keeps going. Each round gets smaller, but when you add it all up, that initial $100 injection can actually lead to a $500 increase in total national income in this example.
Wow. $100 turning into $500. That is a powerful idea.
Yeah.
Especially if you want to, say, kickstart a sluggish economy.
Hugely powerful. It shows how targeted spending can have these amplified effects.
Okay, so it's like dropping a pebble in a pond. The ripples spread out.
That's a good analogy.
But what about businesses? Investment spending, is that purely logical? Driven by spreadsheets, return calculations?
Well, that's part of it, according to Keynes. Investment depends on the marginal efficiency of capital, basically, the expected rate of return.
Compared to interest rates.
Right, compared to the cost of borrowing. But he added a crucial, very human element, animal spirits.
Animal spirits, love that term. It sounds not very spreadsheet-like.
Exactly. It's not about precise calculation. It refers to those waves of optimism and pessimism, that spontaneous urge to action rather than inaction, as he put it.
So gut feelings, confidence, fear.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He saw these psychological forces, these animal spirits, making investment the most volatile, unpredictable part of aggregate demand.
And a primary cause of booms and busts.
Yes. When spirits are high, firms invest, hire, expand. When fear takes over, they pull back, hoard cash, wait and see.
We've all felt that, haven't we? Times when everyone seems optimistic, things are buzzing, or times when fear just hangs in the air.
Absolutely. It's the mood of the market driving real economic outcomes.
And speaking of hoarding cash, let's talk interest rates. How did Keynes challenge the classical view there?
Yes. Another revolutionary idea. The classical view was that interest rates are the price that balances saving and investment.
Makes them equal.
Yes. But Keynes said, no, that's not quite right. Interest is the reward for parting with liquidity.
Liquidity meaning cash.
Yeah.
Easy to access money.
Exactly. It's the price you pay someone to convince them not to hold on to their cash, which is convenient and feels safe.
Why do people want to hold cash?
Well, for everyday transactions, obviously, but also as a precaution against unexpected needs, uncertainty, and for speculation, hoping to profit from future changes in asset prices or interest rates.
Okay, transactions, precautions, speculation.
Right. And this liquidity preference theory explains something really important, the liquidity trap.
Well, liquidity trap, that sounds ominous. What is it?
It's a situation often during a crisis where interest rates are already extremely low, maybe near zero.
Okay.
But people still prefer to hold cash rather than invest it or lend it out. They're just too scared or uncertain about the future.
So even if borrowing is super cheap?
businesses won't borrow to invest, consumers won't borrow for big purchases, everyone's just sitting on their cash.
And what does that mean for, say, central banks trying to stimulate the economy?
It means their main tool, lowering interest rates, becomes ineffective. It's like pushing on a string.
Wow. The mechanism just breaks down.
Yeah, because the desire for liquidity, for safety, overwhelms the low interest rate incentive. It really shows how money isn't just a medium of exchange. It's deeply tied to psychology, to fear and uncertainty.
Okay, so Keynes also had things to say about wages and prices, right? Challenged the idea that just cutting wages would fix unemployment.
He did. The classical view was cut wages, make labor cheaper, firms will hire more. Keynes argued that widespread wage cuts could actually reduce aggregate demand.
Because workers have less money to spend.
Exactly. So overall spending falls, and you might end up with the same level of unemployment, or even worse. It's not so simple.
And what about the money supply? Does printing more money just cause inflation?
Not necessarily, according to Keynes, at least not before you reach full employment. He argued that initially, increasing the money supply boosts demand, which leads to more output and more jobs.
So it affects the real economy first.
Right. Only when resources are fully utilized, everyone's working, factories are at capacity. Only then does further demand pressure just push up prices, causing inflation.
So he saw business cycles as these fluctuations driven by investment confidence, by those animal spirits.
Mm-hmm. Swings in the marginal efficiency of capital, basically.
And given all this potential instability, demand falling short, liquidity traps, wage cuts not working, what was his big conclusion about the role of the government?
Well, in his concluding thoughts, he proposed something pretty bold for the time, a somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment.
Whoa, socialization? Does that mean government ownership?
Not necessarily owning factories and businesses, more that the state should take greater responsibility for guiding and controlling the total volume of investment in the economy.
To keep it stable.
Exactly. To ensure aggregate demand stays high enough to maintain employment, smoothing out those wild swings caused by volatile private investment and animal spirits. The government needed to be a stabilizing force.
Okay, so we've gone through a lot of the specific concepts. If we step back now, what are the big overarching themes, the enduring wisdom from the general theory that's still relevant for us?
Well, several really stand out. First, I'd say the fallacy of composition.
Right. You mentioned this earlier. What's rational for one person might be disastrous if everyone does it.
Precisely. Like everyone trying to save more during a recession. Individually prudent, maybe, but collectively it sinks the economy. It forces you to think systemically.
That's a huge mental shift. What else?
Second, undeniably, the primacy of aggregate demand. This is the absolute core of Keynes. Total spending drives output, drives employment. Full stop.
Got it. Demand is king.
And third, the importance of uncertainty and psychology. Economic life isn't just rational calculation. It's shot through with fundamental uncertainty, with confidence, fear, those animal spirits. Decisions are made in that fog.
And these themes have massive real-world implications. Like the idea of the instability of laissez-faire capitalism. Keynes wasn't saying capitalism was doomed, but...
But that left entirely to its own devices, it's inherently unstable. Prone to booms, busts, and potentially long periods of high unemployment, markets don't automatically self-correct quickly or painlessly.
Which leads to another radical point, involuntary unemployment as an equilibrium state.
Yeah, this was truly revolutionary. Before Keynes, mass unemployment was seen as, well, temporary, a glitch. Or maybe people just didn't want to work for the going wage.
Voluntary unemployment.
Right. Keynes showed, no, the economy can actually settle, find a stable balance point, with millions genuinely wanting work but unable to find it, simply because overall demand is too low.
And there's no automatic force pushing it back to full employment.
Not necessarily. It could stay stuck there.
So, the unavoidable conclusion from all this.
Is the justification for activist government intervention? Since the private sector is prone to these demand shortfalls and volatile swings, the government has not just a right, but maybe even a responsibility to step in.
To manage aggregate demand, stabilize things, fight unemployment using fiscal policy, spending, and taxes.
Exactly. It provides the theoretical underpinning for countercyclical policy.
Now, of course, that idea of government intervention has always been controversial, hasn't it? What are some of the typical worries people raise?
Oh, absolutely. It's a constant debate. Critics worry about government getting too big, making bad decisions, spending inefficiently.
Like, can they time interventions correctly?
That's a big one. Act too late or too much, and you could cause inflation or other problems. There's the risk of Crowding out private investment, government borrowing pushes up interest rates, making it harder for businesses to invest.
And politics gets involved too, right?
Always. Decisions might be made for short-term political gain rather than long-term economic health. So yeah, while Keynes provided the framework, actually doing it effectively is complex and always debated.
Keynes certainly had a way with words, didn't he? Some very memorable lines came out of this work.
He really did. Very quotable.
Like the famous one, "In the long run, we are all dead."
Classic.
Economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task if in tempestuous seasons they can only tell us that when the storm is past, the ocean is flat again.
Yeah, it's such a powerful critique of just focusing on some theoretical long-term equilibrium while people are suffering now. Policy needs to address the present crisis.
Don't ignore the short-term pain. He also said, "The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else."
Which is so true, isn't it? These abstract ideas really do shape policy, shape society, shape our lives in profound ways.
And that term, animal spirits, his definition is great. A spontaneous urge to action rather than inaction, and not as the outcome of a weighted average of quantitative benefits multiplied by quantitative probabilities.
It just perfectly captures that non-rational, almost instinctive driver behind big investment decisions. It's not just numbers.
What else stands out?
Well, he understood how hard it was to shift perspectives. He wrote, "The difficulty lies not in the new ideas, but in escaping from the old ones, which ramify into every corner of our minds."
Breaking free from ingrained thinking.
Exactly. And one more, linked to his idea of reducing the power of passive wealth, the euthanasia of the rentier, he suggested, "It is better that a man should tyrannize over his bank balance than over his fellow citizens."
Meaning it's better to hoard money than to wield excessive power over others through accumulated wealth.
Something like that. A call for a more just distribution, perhaps, reducing the influence of unearned income. These quotes really distill complex thoughts into memorable, challenging ideas.
So let's bring this home. How do these big, sometimes abstract ideas from the general theory actually apply to you listening right now? How do they show up in the world?
Well, the most obvious examples are government responses to recessions.
Like the 2008 financial crisis or the COVID pandemic.
Exactly. Those massive stimulus packages, government spending programs, expanded unemployment benefits. That's pure Keynesian playbook. Countercyclical fiscal policy.
Injecting demand to stop the economy from collapsing further.
Using that multiplier effect to boost income and protect jobs when private spending dries up.
And what about central banks when they cut interest rates?
That's also rooted in Keynesian insight, influencing the money supply and the cost of borrowing to try and encourage investment and spending, managing aggregate demand through monetary policy. Though, as we discussed, that has limits, especially in a liquidity trap.
Okay, so that's the big policy stuff. But how does it connect to our individual lives?
Well, for one, just understanding unemployment, Keynes helps us see it's often a macroeconomic problem, a lack of overall demand, not just millions of individual failings.
It shifts the focus, doesn't it? From blaming the unemployed to thinking about how to manage the whole economy better.
It really does. Then there's the paradox of thrift.
Right. The saving thing.
Yeah.
Individually smart, collectively, maybe not during a downturn.
Yeah. It reminds us that sometimes what seems like common sense for one person can backfire if everyone does it. It helps explain why consumer spending is so crucial.
And the importance of confidence, those animal spirits.
We see that constantly. Consumer confidence surveys, business investment plans, they directly reflect this Keynesian idea. When confidence is high, people spend, businesses invest. When fear dominates, they retrench.
It underlines why clear communication and stable leadership are so important during crises. People need reassurance.
Absolutely. And finally, just for your own personal financial planning, understanding that economies are inherently volatile, prone to these cycles driven partly by psychology.
It helps you prepare.
Yeah. Build emergency savings, diversify investments, maybe be a bit cautious when everyone else seems overly exuberant, or perhaps see opportunity when irrational fear takes hold. It gives you a framework for navigating economic uncertainty.
So wrapping this up, what's the core takeaway? The single most valuable insight from the general theory for us today?
For me, it's the fundamental understanding that free markets, left alone, do not automatically guarantee good outcomes, especially full employment. prolonged involuntary unemployment is a real possibility.
And Keynes gave us both the diagnosis.
The diagnosis being the inherent instability, especially of private investment, driven by those unpredictable animal spirits and uncertainty.
And the prescription.
And the prescription being the potential for government, through thoughtful fiscal policy, to act as a stabilizing force, managing aggregate demand to smooth out the cycles.
It feels like his work wasn't just economics then. It was almost a philosophy for managing society.
I think that's fair. It was a kind of manifesto for pragmatic, humane management of our collective economic destiny. He rejected the idea that we're just helpless victims of blind economic forces.
He gave us tools.
He showed that through intelligent thought, analysis, and collective action, we can understand and manage the economy. We can mitigate suffering, build more stability, more prosperity.
That's quite an optimistic legacy in a way.
It really is a profound optimism about our ability, our capacity to analyze problems and intervene effectively to improve the human condition. That's what endures.
So as you go about your day today, maybe pause and consider, what animal spirits might be swirling around you in the news headlines, in business decisions, maybe even in your own choices about spending or saving? How much are we collectively and individually influenced by those waves of optimism or pessimism that Keynes identified almost a century ago? Something to think about. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the mind of John Maynard Keynes.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.